Knowing what you now know about regression analysis, conventional wisdom, and the art of parenting, consider the following list of 16 factors. According to the ECLS data, 8 of these factors show a strong correlation, positive or negative, with test scores. The other 8 don't seem to matter. Feel free to guess which are which. The child has highly educated parents. The child's family is intact. The child's parents have high socioeconomic status. The child's parents recently moved into a better neighborhood. The child's mother was 30 or older at the time of her first child's birth. The child's mother didn't work between birth and kindergarten. The child had low birth weight. The child attended Head Start. The child's parents speak English in the home. The child's parents regularly take him to museums. The child is adopted. The child is regularly spanked. The child's parents are involved in the PTA. The child frequently watches television. The child has many books in his home. The child's parents read to him nearly every day. Here now are the 8 factors that are strongly correlated with test scores. The child has highly educated parents. The child's parents have high socioeconomic status. The child's mother was 30 or older at the time of her first child's birth. The child had low birth weight. The child's parents speak English in the home. The child is adopted. The child's parents are involved in the PTA. And the child has many books in his home. And now, the 8 factors that aren't correlated. The child's family is intact. The child's parents recently moved into a better neighborhood. The child's mother didn't work between birth and kindergarten. The child attended Head Start. The child's parents regularly take him to museums. The child is regularly spanked. The child frequently watches television. The child's parents read to him nearly every day. Now, 2 by 2. This one matters. The child has highly educated parents, and this one doesn't matter. The child's family is intact. A child whose parents are highly educated typically does well in school. Not much surprise there. A family with a lot of schooling tends to value schooling. Perhaps more important, parents with higher IQs tend to get more education, and IQ is strongly hereditary. But whether a child's family is intact doesn't seem to matter. Just as the earlier cited studies show that family structure has little impact on a child's personality, it does not seem to affect his academic abilities either. This is not to say that families ought to go around splitting up willy-nilly. It should, however, offer encouragement to the roughly 20 million American school children being raised by a single parent. This one matters. The child's parents have high socioeconomic status, and doesn't matter. The child's parents recently moved into a better neighborhood. A high socioeconomic status is strongly correlated to higher test scores, which seems sensible. Socioeconomic status is a strong indicator of success in general. It suggests a higher IQ and more education. And successful parents are more likely to have successful children. But moving to a better neighborhood doesn't improve a child's chances in school. It may be that moving itself is a disruptive force. More likely, it's because a nicer house doesn't improve math or reading scores any more than nicer sneakers make you jump higher. This one matters. The child's mother was 30 or older at the time of her first child's birth, and doesn't matter. The child's mother didn't work between birth and kindergarten. A woman who doesn't have her first child until she is at least 30 is likely to see that child do well in school. This mother tends to be a woman who wanted to get some advanced education or develop traction in her career. She is also likely to want a child more than a teenage mother wants a child. This doesn't mean that an older first-time mother is necessarily a better mother, but she has put herself and her children in a more advantageous position. It's worth noting that this advantage is non-existent for a teenage mother who waits until she is 30 to have her second child. The ECLS data show that her second child will perform no better than her first. At the same time, a mother who stays home from work until her child goes to kindergarten does not seem to provide any advantage. Obsessive parents might find this lack of correlation bothersome. What was the point of all those mommy and me classes? But that is what the data tell us. This one matters. The child had low birth weight. And, doesn't matter, the child attended Head Start. A child who had a low birth weight tends to do poorly in school. It may be that being born prematurely is simply hurtful to a child's overall well-being. It may also be that low birth weight is a strong forecaster of poor parenting, since a mother who smokes or drinks or otherwise mistreats her baby in utero isn't likely to turn things around just because the baby is born. A low birth weight child, in turn, is more likely to be a poor child, and therefore more likely to attend Head Start, the federal preschool program. But, according to the ECLS data, Head Start does nothing for a child's future test scores. Despite a deep reservoir of appreciation for Head Start, one of this book's authors was a charter student, we must acknowledge that it has repeatedly been proven ineffectual. Here's a likely reason. Instead of spending the day with his own undereducated, overworked mother, the typical Head Start child spends a day with someone else's undereducated, overworked mother, and a whole roomful of similarly needy children. As it happens, fewer than 30% of Head Start teachers have even a bachelor's degree, and the job pays so poorly, about $21,000 for a Head Start teacher versus $40,000 for the average public school kindergarten teacher, that it is unlikely to attract better teachers anytime soon. This one matters. The child's parents speak English in the home. And doesn't matter, the child's parents regularly take him to museums. A child with English-speaking parents does better in school than one whose parents don't speak English. Again, not much of a surprise. This correlation is further supported by the performance of Hispanic students in the ECLS study. As a group, Hispanic students test poorly. They are also disproportionately likely to have non-English-speaking parents. They do, however, tend to catch up with their peers in later grades. So, how about the opposite case? What if a mother and a father are not only proficient in English, but spend their weekends broadening their child's cultural horizons by taking him to museums? Sorry. Culture cramming may be a foundational belief of obsessive parenting, but the ECLS data show no correlation between museum visits and test scores. This one matters. The child is adopted. And doesn't matter. The child is regularly spanked. There is a strong correlation, a negative one, between adoption and school test scores. Why? Studies have shown that a child's academic abilities are far more influenced by the IQs of his biological parents than the IQs of his adoptive parents. And mothers who give up their children for adoption tend to have significantly lower IQs than the people who are doing the adopting. There is another explanation for low-achieving adoptees, which, though it may seem distasteful, jibes with the basic economic theory of self-interest. A woman who knows she will put her baby up for adoption may not take the same prenatal care as a woman who's keeping her baby. Consider, at the risk of furthering this distasteful thinking, how you treat a car you own versus a car you're renting for the weekend. But if an adopted child is prone to lower test scores, a spanked child is not. This may seem surprising, not because spanking itself is necessarily detrimental, but because conventionally speaking, spanking is considered an unenlightened practice. We might therefore assume that parents who spank are unenlightened in other ways. Perhaps that isn't the case at all, or perhaps there's a different spanking story to be told.